Might as well then, I'll cover it.
And, just before I start, you can have a look at my beautiful blue eyes, and that's your lot. first of all, I want to say two things. Thank you, Brian, for... can you hear me, guys?
Yeah.
I thank Brian for asking me. He sidled up to me and said, Rob, would you like to speak now? And I said, I thought I'd get off the hook.
You don't need to speak so close.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
I thought I'd get off the hook by saying, but I was a speaker 2 years ago, and Brian was obviously just looking at me saying, but that was 2 years ago, you know. Today is today. So, and that's what I want to thank for that. And I also want to say two more things before I start. The first thing is that there will not be a lot of laughter, I'm afraid, because I'm totally devoid of any sense of humour. So I just want you to know that. And the second thing, I want to just warn you, because I can't see, don't think if you get bored you can slip out without me seeing. If you do, be very quiet, because I will hear you. Anyway, guys, I love the speakers today, and I had a lot in common with most of them. I was a very disturbed child. I was born in Sheffield, and I was brought up by an aunt and an uncle until I was 11 years old. And then I finally ran away from school, and I went to live with my mother in London. But before that, I went to my first school. It was a Roman Catholic school, my little infant school. And I've got to tell you, that when I went to the juniors, I was beaten almost to death by the Brides of Christ. I think it's changed, but in those days, it was pretty tough. And I was also, I had a beautiful boy soprano voice, and I sang in the high church choir, Roman Catholic church choir. But I too, I didn't believe in anything. I was just going through. For God's sake, I was singing, and I learnt the mass in Latin. Didn't understand a bloody word I was talking about. I was singing. Crazy. Anyway, I ran away from home, and I went to live in London. And eventually, the Canadian government, my father's Canadian, he died during the war in 1943, I never knew him, and the Canadian government paid for me to go to a boarding school, and there were quite a lot of posh kids there, and I was a duck out of water, you know. I had to quickly change my accent from, you know, lad, what I'm talking about, Yorkshire accent. I had to get rid of that out of self-defense. And when at this school, I felt like a fish out of water. I felt I developed a massive inferiority complex. And I began to feel ashamed of my background, my working class background, because of these kids talking with snotty accents. And the one thing I remember was, I've never shared in a meeting before, but it's important for me to say it, you know, get it out, is that my father was a soldier in the Canadian Seaforth Highlands. He was a private soldier. But when these guys asked me, I denied my father. I think I said it was something like he was a group captain of the Canadian Royal Air Force. Bullshit, you know. Because I was ashamed of my background. And these all... Somebody pointed out to me in AA, a long time after that, all these kids I was talking to, all their fathers were still alive. My father wasn't. He died in 1943. Anyway... I left school at that school eventually. I left school with them. Can you still hear me?
Yeah.
I left school with them with the 2O levels and a massive inferiority complex. I went into the Merchant Navy at 17 and a half, sailing out of Liverpool to West Africa. And I say this with no pride whatsoever, but I was very proud at the time. At 17 and a half, I could drink these ancient mariners under the table at 17 and a half, and I didn't know why. I was very proud of it. They thought I was amazing. They loved it. So what a guy that is, 17 and a half. Of course, I didn't know then that I had an alcoholic problem. And I must drink some. It's not fear. I'm taking medication. Anyway, I did my job very badly. I was a cadet purser, and I was responsible for the manifest and cargo manifest and that kind of stuff. And our ship was the first ship that ever arrived in Lagos, in Nigeria, with the port papers not ready, because I was still in my bunk, pissed out of my mind. Yeah, really. And messages were getting back to Liverpool, there's something wrong with that kid, you know. There was a rule, you're not allowed to drink under the age of 20. But my bosses fiddled the books for me, and at 70 and a half, I was allowed to drink as much as I could. So that was it. It was unbelievable. I can't describe. I went all down the west coast of Africa. I can't describe any of it because I was drinking, went ashore, drank, at that age, I was with the you know, the big boys, the good drinkers, and they welcomed me because I was one of them. I was a drinker. I was a sailor, you know. God, blimey. Anyway, I'm listening to myself thinking, was that really me? Yes, it was. You know. Anyway, I left the Merchant Navy. This was my pattern then. I left jobs before I got kicked out, and I left the Merchant Navy, and I bummed around for a while. I bummed around in London, and finally somebody said they'd seen an advert in the Telegraph for the army, and you're going to love this, in the army, and it was for the intelligence corps. And I liked the idea of that, you know. So I applied. They thought I was a fit young lad, and I joined the bloody army. It was amazing, I finally ended up wearing no uniform. I worked at GCHQ in Cheltenham. I was an analyst special intelligence, and you know, I was drinking all the time. I was an analyst special intelligence, and as I said in my last speech, I can't tell you what I did because I'd have to kill the lot of you, and that would be a bit difficult. But I, you know, things were getting bad, and I was medically discharged from the army eventually after a couple of years. In my discharge book, I still got it. It talks about this reliable, loyal man of sobriety and all that stuff. And I still got the book to prove that, you know, it wasn't that bad. And anyway, that was it. I left the army for medical reasons, which I won't go into. Not related to drinking those days. Something else was going on. And then I took the examination to join the civil service. By the way, the army. I'm not one of these snobs, you know. I'm not like these people. The civilians who call themselves, you know, they call them the colonel and the major and the brigadier, you know, in civvy street. I don't use my title because it doesn't sound the same. If I call myself Corporal Sordi, the corporal, it doesn't sound quite the same, you know. So I don't do that, you know. So anyway, then I joined the civil service, and I finally became a CO, you know. That was not a chief officer, that was a clerical officer. You know? And then my drinking really took off, you know. I was getting pissed at lunchtimes. Every social event, you know, I was in my 20s by then, I was getting drunk, and it was really getting bad. I was thoroughly disgracing myself. And eventually I started to play the trumpet in those days, and I was going to be a musician, self-taught musician, and I left the civil service. They told me to stay in. It would be a wonderful career. I looked at the grey suits around me and the old people rotting away in the civil service, and I thought, no, this is not for me. There's more to life than this. And then my drinking really took off. I became a sort of bad musician, playing at weddings and that, and getting drunk at weddings. Not my weddings, but the old people. And then I got married. I got married at the age of 20 to a person, a girl called Ava, who was a drinker as well. But I got in touch with her much later in life and made amends to her. And funnily enough, she did say, when I made amends on the phone, she's living in Gosport House, after I finished, she said, well, you know, you were pretty bad, but not that bad. I did the old exaggeration of the alcoholic. I wanted to be the worst alcoholic in the world, you know, if I couldn't be sober. And I didn't do that to myself. So that's it. I was bumming around. I'd left the army. I was in the civil service. And then really, for the rest, the pattern of my life, I worked for various employment agencies, getting various jobs, feeling thoroughly miserable about myself, low self-esteem, having to drink in order to stay... To stay happy, I was going to say. No, to make myself feel okay, you know. And I bummed on. I got a government grant to go and learn. I became a piano technician, a piano tuner for a while. A very bad piano tuner, because to get into mechanism, you need very long screwdrivers. And the customers used to watch me working on the actions, screwdrivers like this, trying to get the tip of it into the bloody piano. You know, it was ridiculous. And then I met a Belgium girl, and that's where I'd ended up in Brussels. I came over to Brussels, and for a while I managed not to drink because we stayed with their parents for a while. But of course, you know, I didn't know I was an alcoholic then, but then I suddenly I picked a row with my girlfriend, and the shit hit the fan. I started to drink, and then the parents were saying, get rid of him, you know? And I was starting to do something, if not criminal, very immoral, and that was to drive, knowing that my sight was failing, and I could have killed somebody. I didn't kill anybody, I didn't kill myself, but finally my eyes were getting bad, and I thought, this is really looking a bit dodgy. She went off and married a bloody French guy, actually. She realized she couldn't change me, and she just left me. There was no love there, you know. I was glad when she left me, but I gave her a hard time. How can you do this to me? You know, don't leave me, you know. I was lonely and afraid for a while, you know, until I found it. Anyway, I'm trying to keep it short. There's a lot of detail. I was in trouble with the police in London. I lost my license, my driving license. I lost a job. I was a rep. I was a rep for a firm called Brewhurst Health Food Supplies. What a bloody, you know, publicity for them. A wreck turning up at shops trying to sell things, you know, with no confidence, nothing, you know. Anyway, thank God. Does anybody know the Devil's Punch Bowl in Surrey? One day I got into a pub, got pissed up my mind, and that was it. It was over. I was going to drive to the Devil's Punch Bowl, turn the wheel the wrong way and kill myself. I don't know whether I would have done, but thank God. Huh? The police picked me up. And that was it. I went to court, lost my license, and that was it. The next time, and when I finally went up to London, I was arrested by the police for being drunk and disorderly. And I met a surgeon, a police surgeon there, because I was registered disabled in those days. And this police surgeon said, "What the hell are you doing here?" I had no record, nothing. "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I didn't know," and unfortunately he didn't know either, you know, except he didn't say, "Well, you know, you're drinking too much, you're a drunk." And that was it. So I just continued to drink for a long, long time in Belgium. And finally, I'm glad to say that I've got recovery to talk about. One day somebody not in the program came round, and I was in misery. I wasn't playing music or anything. I was living off some money that I'd inherited, and it was all slowly trickling away, and I was just using that for drink, and finally the social service in Belgium kind of started to take me over, and a guy came around and said, "You're a drunk," and for the first time I was able to say, "Yeah, you're right." And this guy, not in AA, phoned AA up in Brussels, and some guy came along, my dear friend, who was my first sponsor. He's 90 now, living in the 90s. He's living in Canterbury. His wife died recently. And it's nice for me because I'm 71, guys, and he's 90. He calls me son. I love it, you know. It makes me feel very young, you know. And he took me to my first meeting, and when I got to the meeting, I had the shakes, I was sweating, and people, you know, were sharing all the little bit of their story, and then the chairman noticed my agitation and said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "No, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in God. That's my problem." And of course, they knew what my problem was. It was more than that. I was a drunk, and they all laughed and said, "Don't worry about it. We'll explain things afterwards." And I came back because I had nowhere else to go. I was lonely, and I kept coming back. But I must say, it's important for me to tell certainly newcomers that although I got there in 1984, I didn't sober up till 1986. No, sorry, I got there in 86 and didn't sober up till 89. So I was 3 years in the program getting drunk. I just didn't get the message. I had no confidence. Why should I succeed at this? I've been a failure all my life. It's fine for you lot, but I can't do it. I've never succeeded at anything. So, you know, all that time, I had nothing to believe in. I had no faith in myself or anything else. And then finally, one day after my last drunk, and it was my sobriety days, sorry, can you hear me? I'm not sure that my... It's 15th of August, 89. And that day after my last drunk, I went home. Some guy, I forget his name now, somebody who went back to the station, he came up and says, "Listen, tomorrow morning, get on your knees and ask God for help." And I said, "Well, you know, I'm not sure. I don't really believe in God." He said, "Nobody cares. Nobody will see you. Just get on your knees and try it." And that was it. AA, the program, was getting me, because I had come to believe, because I went home that morning, it was the 15th of August, I in the morning when I woke up, I got on my knees and I said, okay, God, and I identified with David with that. I said, if you're out there, please excuse me for not really believing you, but I need your help. Can we do it your way? I'm killing myself. And I don't recommend this for anybody, but it's part of the story. I also said, I'm asthmatic. And I also said, and by the way, while we're at it, could you figure out how I could stop smoking? I have not had a drink or a cigarette since that day. And it was because at last I realized I've got masses of willpower, you see. It's all right. Anyway, that was it. So I could, and I want to tell you something. That was my spiritual awakening, because for the first time I knew that when I was going to wake up, when I was going to go to my next meeting, I got ready for the meeting that day, and I knew in my heart that this was going to be okay this time. I just knew that I was going to be able to do it and stay sober and do and listen to people and do what you're all doing together collectively. I can join the party and stay sober one day at a time. And I might add, my first meeting, I'll show you how sick I was. After the meeting, there was this beautiful American woman came up to me and wrapped her arms around me and said, it's good to see you. And, you know what's coming, don't you? I said, that's it. I haven't lost my sexual charisma. Great. Yeah. I haven't lost everything. Anyway, that was it. And slowly but surely, that morning I did the three steps. I knew then that I was an alcoholic and that my life was totally unmanageable. And then I had come to believe, and I could make that decision. And then I could get on with my sobriety. And then I started to work the steps and go regular to meetings. And I keep it simple. I keep the program is simple. It's not easy, but it's simple. And I can make it as complicated as I wish. And, sometimes I can do that. I still have these silences of God. I call my God the Great Spirit, because I have American, North American, Indian blood in me, which I'm proud of. My great mother was Cree Indian, and I'm proud of that. And so far I haven't wanted to scalp anybody, but it might have come. You never know. So that was it. I was able then to get on with sobriety. Then I started to realize that there were some wonderful people out there, not in the program. The world was a hostile place for me. But when I got sober, I met many good people outside. I got my music back. I started playing with a band. I still play with this band. And AA has given me a wonderful gift. It gave me a second chance at life. And it gave me the opportunity at my age. I was 44 when I got on the program. I was 49 when I finally 47 wasn't I? Yeah, 47 when I finally sobered up. I was given the gift of realizing I could reach my potential as a human being. First of all, suggestions were made that I need to do these things in order not to drink. But then when I started working the program, the wonderful thing happens to us all. I wanted to not drink and to work this program, this spiritual program, in order. I wanted to be a better person. I wanted to be there for people. I wanted to be a good person. Not because I had to stop drinking, not drink in order to be a good person. I wanted to be that person that I think the God I pray to meant me to be, and I got in the way for many, many years. And AA gave me that wonderful, they gave me the tools to do that. Just one day at a time. And, I often said, in August 15th, I was 24 years sober. The reason I'm saying that is because in meetings, I always say to, for the benefit of newcomers and beginners, that, I'm doing exactly what everybody else is doing in this room today. I'm looking after 24 hours. The years look after themselves, but I have got to look after my 24 hours. And I do that by sticking close to my program, to meetings, and talk to... Well, I must mention John, because I met John in AA, and we developed a beautiful friendship and a musical friendship as well. And we kind of sponsored each other. And I've got a funny feeling the bugger's still sponsoring me up there somehow. I keep getting little ideas in my head. and it's wonderful. And I want to, this is a part of verse of my story. There's so many details, but the main thing I want to tell you is that my life nearly ended with drink. I felt suicidal, and I thought my life was over at 44 years of age. Well, you know, the God I pray to, the Great Spirit, had other plans for me, and it's to do with all of you. It's to do with finding a group of wonderful people who are there to help me to stay sober and to grow. And before I forget, sorry, I've got to jump. I want to say that I thank you all. You, when John died, John used to look after me. We were called the odd couple, you know. And dare any of you come and say, can I help you with the food? He'd push you in and say, no, I'm the only one who knows how he likes his muesli, you know. And that was one. And of course, when he died, I thought, well, I'll go to meet, but I'll have, it's patheticness, I'll have nobody to look after me. But I've noticed you've all been fighting to get at me. It's wonderful. And seriously, I do thank you all, because you're a blessing for me, all of you. Every time I've obviously needed a bit of help, there's always been somebody there looking, coming up saying, Rob, can I help you? And I've learned to say, yes, please, instead of, I don't need any help, you know, I don't need you lot, you know. I don't do that much. So you are a blessing for me. I feel very, I'm not going to say I'm lucky. I don't, well, I anybody else could say they're lucky, but it's not luck. I'm very fortunate. And when I think of all the poor people out there who don't make it, who are not fortunate, I'm just blessed. I'm one of the fortunate ones. And I will continue to do what I'm doing one day at a time. And my faith is that... you know, I keep saying I'm not religious, but it's funny enough, I keep popping into the local church in Brussels and saying the Lord's Prayer and having a chat with God, and my father is up there. I want to tell you very quickly, and then I guess it's time, is it? Yeah. I found my father in Sabide. He's buried in a Canadian war cemetery in Sicily. I thought he'd been blown up. I didn't know he existed. My mother and family never talked about him. I was an only child. But the wonderful thing is, thanks to fellowship, I found on the internet, some friends helped me to find my dad's grave in the war cemetery in Canada. I went there. I said hello to my father and goodbye to him. And I spent the afternoon, to my surprise, I burst into tears. And I cried for about an hour. I was so overwhelmed with that, and because of that, I found my Canadian family, and they welcome me with open arms. I've been given so many gifts by AA, and you know, I try and give back as much as I can. Being visually handicapped, I'm limited, but you know, I'm there for people. I try to be there for people, and blow me down. You know, I've discovered, I thought for a while I was being altruistic, you know, if I did something for somebody. You know, in the old days, I used to do something for somebody because they were going to do something for me. I was going to get a payoff for it. But nowadays, if I do something, it's not altruism, because, you know, I've discovered that being kind to people, or trying to be kind most of the time, and being giving instead of taking stuff, I've discovered it makes me feel wonderful. You know, and that's magic. You know, what a gift. So I guess that's it. I've been in trouble with the police. I lost jobs all the time. I ruined all my friendships. I had lots of girlfriends. I quickly say this because it's important. I totally screwed up a relationship. I had a mentally handicapped daughter. I screwed up the relationship. I wasn't married. And she might... She might be dead now. She was nobody knew what the prognosis was, but she was mentally handicapped. And because of my drinking, I blame myself, of course. I was a monster, of course. I produced a mentally handicapped child, and I was really awful. I've never been able to get in touch with her mother. People have tried from the internet, various channels, to try and find out. And maybe we think once we got in touch with her, then maybe she just didn't want to know. Because if I could make amends, that's a really big amends I would love to make. But maybe it's not meant to be. Maybe it would hurt her. You know, I make amends in my heart to that woman. Her name was Sally, and my daughter Juliet, who. Well, that's enough of that, but it needs mention, because it was because of my drinking that happened. You know, I was dreadful to her, and that was because of my bloody drinking, you know. I wasn't responsible, you know. Everything got in my way. It was all about me. So, do you think that's enough? Okay, guys. Listen, as I say, thank you once more, and thank you for letting me speak, and thank you for looking after me.